Shavuos. I was at home, assuming that I would prepare all of my shiurim and drashas for Yom Tov. However, I had non-stop phone calls the whole Erev Yom Tov, and I couldn't understand why is it that more people make more mistakes in the kitchen on Erev Yom Tov than any other Erev Shabbos. And I'm pretty silly for not figuring it out till my father-in-law came to visit us on Erev Yom Tov, and he saw I was in a tizzy a little bit because I had not prepared at all. I was busy on the phone for hours and hours on Erev Yom Tov. There must be at least 50 trefa pots in Woodmere. I don't know what was happening. And my father-in-law said to me, no, it's only Shavuos because they have milchiks and fleishiks that everyone's cooking, so that's where they make the mistakes. But on a regular Shabbos, you don't make such mistakes. He's probably correct. So many, many different shilas came up. One of the shilas that I was surprised that did not come up is the issue of milchik bread. And I assume the reason why nobody asks is because most people probably are unaware and don't think about it. But I think it's something that we should be aware of and we should consider. And certainly around the Yom Tov of Shavuos, it's something that many people might have to take into careful consideration. So let's begin with a Gemara in Psachim Daf Lamed and Zvachim Daf Sadi Hei. I don't know if we'll have a chance to go through all of these different things on here, but I just put some OU files that are a little bit off the record, so don't spread them around. But these OU files are might be helpful to understand some of the issues that we're going to discuss and some of the policies that the OU sets regarding milchik bread and muffins and crackers, we'll see. So the Gemara says as follows, Ein lashin esa isa b'chalav. One is not allowed, one is not permitted to be lush, to knead the dough with milk. Vim lush, kol hapas asura mipnei hergal aver. And if you do go ahead and put milk into the mixture, into the dough, the entire batter is not going to be edible. You're not allowed to eat it because of hergal aver. Now, what does hergal aver mean? What's it going to lead to? What's the problem? So the concern is, because one of the staples of humanity, or certainly in the times of the Gemara, one of the staples of life was bread, if you're going to have bread that's going to be milchiks, then we're concerned maybe you're going to take it to your meal, which is going to be fleishiks, and then you're going to eat milchiks and fleishiks in the same meal. Therefore, we say mipnei hergal aveira, because it's going to lead to somebody perhaps making a mistake and eating this bread in the fleishik meal. Therefore, we say you should stay away and not make milchik bread. Kayotsebo, and similarly, in tashin esatanur be'alya, one should not smear the outsides, or I mean the insides of the oven with some meaty sauce. Vim tash kalapas kula asur. And if you do that, and now your bread is baked in that oven. Now the bread is going to have some pe'en, some residue from what you smeared all over the oven. We assume that bread would not be permissible to be eaten. This is quoted in Shulchan Aruch and Yerudea, Simon Sadi Zayin, that if you have bread that has blios from chalav or from brasar, we assume that it's not going to be permissible. Again, the Shulchan Aruch says it goes both for milchik bread and for fleishik bread. You're not allowed to make either of them. Now, the Achronim have a further machlokus if the Shulchan Aruch says, based on this Gemara, that you're not allowed to have milchik bread or fleishik bread because maybe you're going to eat it with the opposite meal. What about things that are commonly used in all meals? Let's say, for example, spices. So we use pepper in all of our meals. So what if I have pepper that has, meaning some gravy fell into the pepper, and most probably wouldn't use it, but let's say you crush it up again, and now the gravy is still mixed in there, you have a tom of busser in there, are you able to keep that pepper in the house? Obviously you're not allowed to sprinkle it onto your lasagna or whatever it is, but are you allowed to leave it in your house, or do we assume no, since pepper is very commonly used in all the different foods that we eat, maybe we're concerned that you're going to end up making that mistake. Or, for example, water or wine or all these different things, should we assume something that's generally eaten or consumed with either milchiks or fleishiks, is there a concern that maybe you shouldn't be allowed to make those milchiks or fleishiks either? So that's a machlokes, the Tazan, the Magen Avraham, and other achronim, the Yad Yehuda, Pischei Tshuva. And basically, I think the practice in most kashrus agencies is that we are makel on that. We assume, no, you leave it as what the Shulchan Aruch told us is usher. So that would be milchik bread and fleishik bread, and not other food items that also might lead to a mistake. For example, water, wine, spices, or things like that, we would assume are not included in this takana. Now, my father pointed out to me once that this violation of pas chalavi, of milchik bread, would apply even to somebody who's a vegetarian, let's say. Even to somebody who's a vegetarian who would never eat fleishiks anyway, for whatever reason. Either they're allergic or they're vegetarian because they choose to be. But they never eat fleishiks, and they have never eaten fleishiks, or they will not eat in the near future. Still, we would assume that the gzeira is the gzeira, and you're not allowed to have milchik bread around the house, and you're not allowed to bake it. Reverend Wendor Soloveitchik learned this halacha of milchik bread in shul. In shir, he presented the following very fundamental question that we have to think about, that a lot of the consideration of the details of milchik bread are going to ride on this very issue. So he wanted to know the following. Should we assume that milchik bread is just an iser mitam gzera? Is milchik bread just, they're afraid maybe it's going to lead to something else, therefore they said, don't make this bread because maybe you'll come to make a mistake later? Or is it that, no, yes, the impetus of the gzera was, we're concerned maybe it's going to lead to something else, but once they said you're not allowed to do it, now if you make milchik bread, it becomes machalas asuris. It's like chazer. So you'll say, what's the difference? Either way, I'm not allowed to eat it, right? So what should the difference be? So very simply, the difference will be with regard to kashering the kelim. Right? That should be the nafkamina. With regard to kashering the kelim, that should be the most simple nafkamina. Again, if you say it's just a gzera that you're not allowed to eat it, so therefore you shouldn't bake it, then the kelim don't become treif. But if you say it's really machalas asuras, if I take a pot and I cook real tarfus in the pot, I cook chazer in the pot, obviously I'm going to have to kasher my pot. So over here as well, that's one of the major issues that comes up, as we'll see in a couple of minutes here, with regard to kashering kelim that were used to create milchik bread. That's the most obvious nafkamina. I don't know why Rav Soloveitchik didn't mention that nafkamina in Shir. He spoke about a fancy nafkamina. The fancy nafkamina goes as follows. Let's look at the Rambam. In general, what halacha when it comes to making a bracha on machalas asuras? So you'll say, what do you mean, making a bracha on machalas asuras? You're not allowed to eat it. Why should you have to make a bracha on it? So you'll say, we're talking about a person who realizes afterward that he ate machalas asuras. Now he wants to know, should I make a bracha achrona? Well, on the one hand, I had hana, and a bracha is for somebody who has hana. On the other hand, you'll say, what do you mean I had hana? You had hana, but it was from something you weren't allowed to have hana. So what are you going to say? Botzea berech neretz Hashem. That's a awful thing to do, to make a bracha on something which is usher. So how can you go ahead and make a bracha? Let's see. The Rambam writes as follows. Rambam menuchos brachos, perak aleph, halacha yutes. Let's learn the Rambam together. Kala ochel davar ha'usher. If somebody eats something which is usher, bein bizadon, either you're eating it on purpose, or bishgaga, and you realize after you finished eating it that this is what you just consumed. Eino mevarech alav lo betchila v'lo besof. Person does not recite a bracha at all, both before you eat that item and after the item is eaten. You do not recite a bracha rishona or a bracha achrona. Ketzad, says the Rambam. Hareshaal chal tevel, if you have somebody who goes ahead and eats tevel, which is isur daraisa. Tevel is when you haven't yet been mafris truma. Afilu tevel de devrayim, even if you go ahead and you eat, Tevel midrabanan, meaning sometimes you have something which in its very nature is not obligated in Trumas HaMaisers on a level of Daraisa. It's only chayiv in Trumas HaMaisers midrabanan. So if you go ahead and eat something like that, still, says the Rambam, you wouldn't have to make a bracha. Or, Sha'acha Maisa Rishon Shalom Nadlu Kal Trumosav, O Maisa Sheni Vehektor Shalom Niftu Kil Chasan, Eino Mavarach, says the Rambam, you don't recite a bracha. Ve'ein Sarach Lomar, says the Rambam, certainly, this would be the case if a person goes ahead and eats nevelus or trefos. If you eat something which is really treif, not just tevel, which can somehow be fixed up if you take the truma off of it. No, if you go ahead and you eat nevelus or trefos, or you shasa yayin nesach, you drink wine that you're not allowed to drink, certainly, says the Rambam, you wouldn't recite a bracha, not before it, not after it, because that is something that you're not allowed to be eating. The Ravid jumps on the Rambam. He says, what do you mean? How can you say you don't recite a bracha? Zak the Ravid, look at this in the middle of the paragraph. Tavazeh toz gedolo, says the Rambam. What are you talking about? The Ravid says, how can you say that you don't recite a bracha before eating this or after eating it? What do you mean? Just because it's treif? Shalo amru eim avarchem. The Gemara never says that you don't recite a bracha on something which is usher, or you don't recite a bracha on eating tevel. All the Gemara says in brachos is, ein mezamnin aleha. If you have three people sitting around and they go ahead and they eat tevel together, so you don't make a mezumin. The Gemara never says that you don't make a bracha on it, it just says you don't make a mezumin on it. So how does the Rambam come off to say an extra chiddush that not only do you not make a mezumin, you don't recite a bracha either? Says the Ravid, shein lanu kviyas leziman hova ochlen davar aser. Who kein achilas peir shein kavua leziman. Not important for now. Ava bracha tchila b'sof. However, regarding a bracha before you consume the item, or after you finished eating it, lama lo yivarchu, hol v'nenu. Bottom line, kol anenu min olam hazeh b'lo bracha ki'ilu mal. If a person goes ahead and eats something without reciting a bracha, it's as if you have stolen from God. It's as if you're stealing his food. So how can you say, just because you're eating something which is usher, or you realize that you just have eaten something which is not permissible to eat, how can you tell me, Rambam, that you're not allowed to recite a bracha before or after? Isn't that a violation of kol anenu min olam hazeh b'lo bracha ki'ilu mal? So how do you understand the Rambam? How's the Rambam going to answer? Isn't that a good question? Bottom line, I enjoyed the treifa steak that I just ate. Bottom line, I enjoyed the tevel I ate. Kol anenu min olam hazeh b'lo bracha ki'ilu mal. So how do you not recite a bracha? How do you not recite a bracha?
It wasn't meant for you to enjoy.
What?
It wasn't meant for you to enjoy.
Therefore?
Therefore, why you would make a bracha on it if you weren't supposed to enjoy it?
So what would you say? If I steal food from somebody else's house, do I recite a bracha on it?
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
Yes, why? Wasn't meant for you to enjoy. Right? So I think part of what the Rambam is getting at is the following. We have a Gemara in Bechoros Daf Lamed Zayin. I'm not sure, but I think this is what the Rambam gets at. It's a similar kind of idea. I think the Rambam's understanding is, and we'll see from the Gemara, it's totally from left field, but it's similar to this a little bit. I think what you see from the Rambam is when a person eats something which is treif, that's not called getting hana. Not that it wasn't meant to be enjoyed, but that's not called getting hana. What do you mean? Bottom line, I ate something. Bottom line, I'm not hungry anymore. That's not called hana. What? Right, so let's see as follows. Gemara says in Mechoros Daf Lamed Zayin. This is just my suggestion in the Rambam. I think this is what he means. The Gemara says in Mechoros as follows. Hamocher basar lachaver. Let's say I am a salesman, and I sell basar to my friend, some meat to my friend, v'nimtza basar b'chor. And it turns out that it's meat that I'm not allowed to eat. It's a carbon. It's something, it's hektish. It's something I wasn't really allowed to sell. So, dvarim shanefesh katzabahem, or something that is not edible. So the Gemara goes through a list there of all the things that have a right to go back to the butcher and say, hey, you sold me something which is not edible, you sold me something which is a week old, it doesn't taste good, it doesn't smell good, or you sold me nivelus atrefus, or you sold me something which is a bechar, it's hektish, it's something I'm not allowed to eat. So in that case, I'm allowed to go back to him, full refund. Even if I already ate a half a steak, I'm still allowed to go back to him and give him the rest and ask for a full refund. So the Achronim say that not only does the Gemara mean that I can get a full refund for what I give him back, I'm even able to allow to get the full refund for the part of the meat that I ate. I'm even allowed to get a refund for the part of the meat that I already ate. When I go back to the butcher, I can say to him, I bought $20 worth of meat, I want $20 back. Ah, you already ate $5, $6 of the meat, you already took a couple of bites off. So why should I give you $20? You enjoyed it. So the Gemara says you don't have to. Why? The Poskim explained, because had I known that this was a trefa, had I known that this was machalas hasuras, I would have more preferred not eating it at all. That's not called a hana. So you'll say, bottom line, you're satiated. Bottom line, you have food in your stomach. You don't have to eat dinner tonight. Doesn't matter. Had I known this was going to be the case, that's not called a hana at all. That's what the Gemara says. And this is quoted in Shulchan Aruch Shemishpat Lahalachan Simereish Lamadala, that we have a right to say, if somebody sells you an item which is not permissible to be eaten, you can go back at a full refund, even for the money of what you've already eaten. So I think here's another case where you find, I ate something, I had hana, so why am I getting paid back for it? I should have to pay him that money. I'm making him lose. Answer is, and again, we're not talking about a butcher that does it on purpose. You have a butcher that does it on purpose, it's his problem. What? Yeah, so that's an interesting question. If he does a b'mezid, why? So it sounds very much like the Rambam, a little bit, but when he does a b'mezid, why is it different? But the problem is, if this is true, that somebody who eats machalas asuras is not called really getting hana, listen to the brilliant kasha of Rabbi Kiva Eiger. Rabbi Kiva Eiger has an unbelievable kasha. Look, yes. He says, l'chorer kasha, if you're going to assume that this Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch are correct, that somebody who eats machalas asuras is not called getting hana, ask Rabbi Kiva Eiger a very good question. What's the halacha? If a person goes ahead and eats truma, and I happen not to be a kohen, so what's my obligation? What do I have to do? I have to pay karen, the amount of money for what I ate, plus a chomesh. We knas you, we say you have to do more. Halo mikri nana klal. What do you mean? What am I eating right now? I'm eating something which is treif to me. Something which is only allowed to be eaten by kohanim. So what will you say? Bottom line, don't you see from this Gemara that if I eat something which is machalas asuras, it's as if I didn't eat at all? So ask Rabbi Kiva Eiger, why should we knas you? Why should we make you pay an extra chomesh? Isn't it considered like you didn't eat at all? So for example, Rabbi Kiva Eiger brings the point home and he says, let's say I take shemen shel truma, right? You have oil that belongs to the kohanim because oil is truma. So you have the oil that belongs to the Kohanim. So what are you supposed to do with the oil? Back in the times of the Gemara, there used to be sach b'shem shel truma. That's what they used to do. So I go ahead and I drink it, right? So I made the Kohanim lose, but I didn't use it in the normal way that it's supposed to be used. So in a case like that, we don't make you pay karen v'chomesh because you didn't do the normal kederach hana also. As for Rabbi Kiva Eiger over here also, the way that you're supposed to eat food is to eat it and have anah. Over here, this is not called having anah because I ate something which is usur. So this is what Rabbi Akiva Eiger is dealing with. I don't want to get too into it. You can read it on your own. But what I find interesting is Rabbi Akiva Eiger is taking this very seriously. Rabbi Akiva Eiger says, don't you see from the Gemara, if you eat something that's treif, it's considered like you didn't eat at all. And that's why you're allowed to go back to the butcher and say, I want a full refund of the money. Therefore, ask Rabbi Akiva Eiger, how are you going to understand the story about Truma? Person goes ahead and eats Truma. It's machalas hasuras. The reason why we say you have to pay Karen v'chomesh is because it's as if you have gone ahead and gotten hana from something you weren't allowed to. Ask Rabbi Akiva Eiger, why is that called getting hana? Amazing kasha. But I think when you see all of that, I think it brings the Rambam a little bit more to life. The Rambam over here says that when you eat something which is a davar ha'asur, you don't have an obligation to go and make a bracha, and in fact, you're not allowed to make a bracha. The Rambam doesn't explain why. Ask the Ravid, isn't that called getting hanah? How can you tell me just because you're eating something which is treif that you shouldn't go and make a bracha? I think the answer is, the Rambam says, just like the Gemara says, that when you eat something which is treif, you're not mechuyev to make a bracha because that's not called getting hanah. Period. So you'll ask, what about mezid? I don't know. Yeah? Yeah.
Sounds like a good answer. So,
yeah,
so. It's not like you're right back to where you started from.
That's why, you know, I don't want to deal with Rabbi Akiva Eiger. It's complicated a little bit, but I think it's an interesting point that he raises to consider. It's a point to think about. Now. That's what it sounds like. That's what you have to say in the Rambam. But it's, you know, you need to work on it a little. He still needs a little bit of work. Yeah. So I still think the Rambam would say you don't make a bracha, even though you have to eat this because this is bottom line. You're not happy about what you're doing. You're not happy about what you're doing. It's uncomfortable for you. You're not happy about what's happening. So again, what?
In what case could you ever not make a bracha because you ate pishogi? You always
the bracha achrona. The bracha achrona. Let's say after I finish eating, somebody comes in and says, oh, you bought the wrong meat, this, that, it was truma, it was something else. So we assume in a case like that, you wouldn't make a bracha achrona. So again, the Rambam says over here that one would not recite a bracha on machalas asuras, one would not recite a bracha on eating something which they're not allowed to eat, and this is the way the Mechaber paskens as well, in Arachayim Simen Kuf Tzadi Vav, like the Rambam, that we do not recite a bracha, and we reject the opinion of the Ravid. Now, Rav Soloveitchik said, this is only going to be the case if you're eating something which is a chetz of the Yisura, if you're eating something which is Nebelus Atrefus, if you're eating something which wasn't Shechted, if you're eating something which is really Trefa Davar Aser. However, if, let's say, you eat something which is only Aser Mitam Gzeira, so Rav Soloveitchik argued, this is like a very fancy nafgamina, it's not the simplest one I would have said, Rav Soloveitchik said, if I only eat something which is Aser Mitam Gzeira, then perhaps I would recite a bracha. So let's say, take a test case. What if I ate Bishalaku? Right? So that's a similar case. So what would he say there? Would you recite a bracha on eating bishalakum, or would you say, no, a bracha should not be recited? Well, on the one hand, it's exera midrabanan mishum benoseyam, because we're concerned if you're going to go ahead and eat the food of the non-Jew, you're going to come to marry their children down the line. So is it only exera, or does bishalakum become machalas hasuras? That's a very fundamental question that the Ran deals with, and the Ran says, in general, we have to ask, what is the status of bishalakum? The same question that Rav Soloveitchik had over here by milchig bread, that's the suffix that the Ran has by pasakum and bishalakum. Do we assume that bishalakum now becomes an iser midirabanan, and therefore all the kalim that were used that the non-Jew cooked in now have to be koshered, and we need shishim to outdo anything that might fall in that's bishalakum into a pot of soup, or do we assume, no, this is not machalas asuras, all this is just exerim midirabanan, you shouldn't eat it, but it doesn't make the pots treif. This is a major suffix when it comes to bishalakum. And the Ran says that all, you know, the Ran talks about this extensively, and it's very strange because in Shulchan Aruch there seems to be a split in the psak. On the one hand, we say that when it comes to bishalakum, you have to kasher the kalim, which seems to indicate that it's machalas asuras, that it's really treif, otherwise the kalim don't become treif. On the other hand, the Shulchan Aruch, when he talks about how much you need to be mevatel the bishalakum, if it falls into another pot, he seems to go against the regular principles of bitul berov, bitul b'shishim. So it seems not to be machalas asuras, it seems only to be exer midirabanan. So that's a very complicated halacha. How do we deal with that? And therefore, when it comes to milchig bread, we have to ask the same question. What is the status of milchik bread? Do we assume it's exerim midrabanan, or do we assume it's machalas asuras? And the nafkamina will be with regard to kashering a pan that was used to bake the milchik bread. So let's look at number hay, where the OU chimes in over here. So my father was vacillating back and forth whether or not we should assume this is like Bishul Akum and it needs to have kashering, or we should assume it's not like Bishul Akum and it doesn't have to be kashered at all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How come nobody really focuses on whether it's an Isser on the Chatzah versus the Gavra concept? Would that be a difference?
I think that's basically what this question is.
Is it?
Is it Exerim Midrabanan?
Midrabanan, but it's still on the item. Or you could have something that's on the person.
No, that's basically Rav Soloveitchik's question here. It's certainly only Midrabanan. This din of not having milchik bread is certainly only Midrabanan. The question is it on me that I shouldn't eat it and I shouldn't bake it because maybe I'm going to bring myself to do something worse? Or is it that it now itself, the chepsa itself, turns into a machalas asuras? That's exactly the question that we're dealing with. It's a better way to say it, perhaps. That's exactly the question that we're dealing with. So the question is, do we have to kasher something that was used to make milchik bread or not? So that's the question that the OU was back and forth about, and they weren't sure. First, the OU wrote that it does not require kashering, because we assume it's not machalas asuras. Then, later on, my father wrote a tshuva where he rescinded his opinion, and he felt that now the OU has to take upon themselves that it is considered like machalas asuras, and we do have to kasher the kelim if there was milchik bread that was cooked in them. So let's see. Lamaskana, my father writes, the bottom line is, tvei nira lomer. If these kelim were already baked in more than 24 hours ago, we're not going to get into the whole cheshbon, but basically he says, once 24 hours have passed, then you have a right to rely and say, we don't have to kasher them. If they are still a ben yomo, if you just cooked in them recently, and it's within 24 hours, and the bleas are still somewhat, not hot, but they're somewhat still there, so then we assume, pshita de tzvichan lahachshiram. Because now if you're going to go ahead and bake something else within 24 hours in this pan, now the new bread is going to become milchik also. Okay?
We can have
Milchik
bread that's cooked in milk.
So again, so let's just back up a little bit. We're not learning all of Yeruday here tonight, but I think it's important to make note of the following. Generally, the real halacha is once 24 hours have passed, whatever bleas are inside of the kelim are as if they're not there at all. Nothing's really going to come out after 24 hours. Even if it does come out, we assume it's no sentam lefgam. It's not going to help. It's not going to help better the food that you're cooking now. It's going to make, if anything, it's going to make the food worse, the bleas that are coming out after 24 hours. So why is it that we kasher the kelim? You should only have to kasher them within 24 hours. Why do you have to kasher after 24 hours? So the Gemara says it's gzeira eina ben yomo, ata ben yomo. We say, really, the only time you have to kasher is when it's within 24 hours. But we're concerned you're going to have stickers all over your house. This is the way my father taught it to us in Shir. He said, you're going to put a sticker on your house that says, we use this at 8 o'clock in the morning, don't use it till 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Then you're going to have a sticker on the other one that's going to say, we use this at 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock and 7 o'clock. But now, you're going to put all the kelim back into the drawer, back into the cabinet, and all the stickers are going to stick onto the other kelim. You're not going to remember what was what. Therefore, we say, Eina ben yomo, ata ben yomo, you have to make sure to kasher all the kelim. But really, that's just a din de rabbanan that we tacked on to the original din of kashering the kelim. So again, when you have a case like this, which is so unclear whether or not it really needs to be kashered at all, and we're not even sure if it's machalas asuras in the first place, so then once 24 hours, you let it wait, and then you don't have to kasher it.
You could do that. In other words, you weren't forced. That's what I was really asking.
Correct. Lechatchila, you would be allowed to do that. Again, lechatchila, you're not allowed to go ahead and bake the bread. But if you make that mistake, just leave the pots, leave the pans for 24 hours, and then there's no reason to have the koshering done for them. Yeah?
Would the kelim, the halach of the kelim apply to an oven as well? In other words, if there's bulia on the oven?
So an oven is very complicated. Oven is a very big machlokas. I'm just going to present to you my father's opinion nowadays, and that is up for major debate. A lot of people disagree with him, but my father makes a distinction between hevel and zeya. He says there's a difference between thick steam and fumes that come up. Let's say when I cook something in the oven. So if I'm cooking a meat that's going to have gravy in it, then hevel comes up. You have real thick steam that comes up from what you're cooking because the gravy is going to evaporate And that goes into the thickness of the walls. When I bake bread, there's no steam that's coming up. Right? So to bake something else at the same time as you're baking the bread, then that's not a good idea. It's going to have bleas from the bread because it's in the oven at the same time. But once you take it out, we don't assume that there's any residue in the oven that's left from something that really can give off thick steam. So that's with regard to that, which is a question more involved in the Yoredeya. And again, it's my father's opinion. Many disagree. But that's the opinion that he follows, that he feels. Now, again, just if anyone wants to follow that opinion, which you can, if anyone wants to follow that, you should make sure that even though that's true, that thick steam and whatever, it's only provided that there's no be'en on the insides of the oven that are left over. Meaning if some of your, if you're cooking, let's say, dry chicken without any schnitzel, let's say, without any gravy on it. So you'll say there's no thick steam that comes up, but if pieces of schnitzel fall off and they're left in the side of the ovens, obviously it's a very different story. You can't go ahead and cook something afterward in that same oven while you still have the residue left over in the oven itself. That would be a very simple thing to keep in mind with regard to this as well.
So if you're baking challah, you should really make sure that nothing was cooked in that oven 24 hours before because of that thick steam?
Well, most of us, I think, keep our ovens pretty clean. And even if something falls down to the bottom of the oven, it's going to be totally burnt out.
Right.
But if you have thick steam... That's a great question. So now does it become fleishig bread?
What if you cover the top?
You don't cover the top when you bake challah. You can't.
No, I'm talking about when you cover the meat.
You're not. No, assume you're not.
Oh, you cover the meat? Do most people cover it or most people leave it open? I don't know.
Yeah, the question's still relevant.
That's a great question.
The question is whether, again...
So again, if I cook my meat with thick steam on Thursday night, and now within 24 hours I'm going to go ahead and cook and bake my bread in the same oven... Why isn't that a violation of fleishig bread? That's a really good question. I don't know.
Maybe it says in washing and sayisa. You actually have to knead it.
Oh, you'll say it's batel b'shishim.
Either right, either that or it's not.
That's probably true. That's probably true. It's probably less than shishim. That's probably true. But isn't that batel iser lechatchila?
Mm-hmm. But even you can cook it side by side. You have to actually knead it.
No, that I don't think is true. No, we'll see a case in a minute, if we get to it, where we'll see that that's not the case. I don't know. Let me think about that. Let me keep it in mind. I don't know. Not sure. So now let's go a little bit further. So we have so far the Gemara that says you're not allowed to make milchig bread, you're not allowed to make fleishig bread. We have Reb Soloveitchik's question, which was, is this that it's machalas asura, so it becomes a real chepzet isura, or do we assume, no, it's just an isur mitam gzeira? So now let's go a little bit further. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Pesachim Daf Lamed Vav. It's a strange Gemara. The Gemara is talking about what kind of stuff you're allowed to put, what kind of ingredients you're allowed to put into the matzah, what you're not allowed to put into the matzah. Says the Gemara as follows. Skip down halfway through the Gemara, because the beginning part is really not relevant for us now. Vahatanya, ask the Gemara, how can you tell me that you're allowed to go ahead and make your matzahs with chalav in them? Vahatanya, ein lashon asa'isa b'chalav. You're not allowed to ever bake bread with milk in it. Ve'im lash, and if you're going to do that, kol ha'pasa surim ipnei hergel aveira. So that's the Gemara's question of Pesachim. How can you tell somebody to go ahead and make matzah that's going to contain milk in it, and you're worrying whether or not it becomes chametz or not, with the milk mixed inside of it instead of water? Aren't you concerned about milchig bread? Forget about chametz. Ella says the Gemara hachikamer. Yoma kama lo telusha li bedufsha, mikam ve'elach lo shu li bedufsha. Okay, that's the first answer. The Gemara, it was a mistake. Really, he told his Talmidim they should go ahead and make him matzahs with honey instead of telling them to make it with milk. So the whole thing's a mistake. Iba yisema la'olam mechalva. No, really he went ahead and told his Talmidim that they should go ahead and bake the bread, they should bake the matzahs with milk in it. Ah, isn't he concerned that maybe it's going to be a violation of milchik bread? So how is he allowed to do that? The Gemara answers, k'deyamar avina ke'ein tura shari. Hachanami ke'ein tura shari. So what exactly does that mean? So if you make it like an ox, ke'ein tura means a shar. If you make it like an ox, then it's mutter. What does it mean? You make bread like an ox. What in the world does that mean? So that's a major subject of debate in the Rishonim. Rashi and the Rif have a disagreement. What exactly does the Gemara mean? Gemara seems to say there's an exception to the rule when one would be allowed to make bread even though it's milchix, but we don't really understand what the exception is. What does ke'ein tura mean? So Rashi explains as follows. Ke'ein tura means if you make very small portions of bread. You make a little bit that you're going to eat. Miyad bevasachas. Right now, I'm making bread for lunch that we're about to eat. So you're about to eat it now. We're not concerned, since you're making such little loaves and you're going to eat them right now, there's no concern that maybe you're going to leave a few over for tonight for dinner and then you're going to have the problem of eating milchigs with fleishigs. Therefore, in a case like that, Rashi says, the Gemara would assume it's not a problem at all. So again, Rashi says, if you're making just a small amount and you're going to eat them miyad, you're going to eat them right away, we would consider that to be no problem at all. And the Rif disagrees. The Rif says, no, that's not what the Gemara means. The Rif says what the Gemara means is, Ke'ein Tura means you make it in a funny shape. You make it in the shape of a horse. You make it in the shape of an ox. That's not the normal way that you would knead the dough. And since you're baking it in a strange way, that's going to be recognizable to anyone who's sitting down to eat a meal. If you serve this at the meal, they're going to say, hey, we're not allowed to eat this now. This is the milchig bread. Now we're in the middle of a fleishig meal. So that's what the Gemara is assuming, that there would be no prohibition of having the milchig bread if it was made in a strange kind of shape. The Shulchan Aruch Halacha L'Maisa brings both the kula of Rashi and the kula of the Rif. So you can rely on either one. Either if you're making a very small amount of bread to be eaten right away, we assume that the issa of pas chalavi, of milchig bread, does not apply. Or if you make bread, even if you make a lot of it, and you're not going to eat it right away, but it's going to be shaped, it's going to be formed in a different way, we assume that also would not be a prohibition, would not be a violation of milchig bread. Now, if Rashi says just a little bit to eat right away is what's necessary in order to allow you to make this bread, what exactly is considered right away? So the Rama writes in a tshuva in the Taras Chatas, the Rama says that if you're going to eat it within the next day, kedei achilas yom echad, that's already considered to be davar mu'at. That's already considered to be a little bit, and therefore the Rama says we would allow you to bake bread in such a fashion. So this is basically a very important machlokas harishonim, but the Shulchan Aruch lahalacha is makel like both opinions. Number one, if it's strangely shaped, strangely formulated, we assume that would be enough of a recognition for a person not to make the mistake. Or if you just make a little bit to be eaten right away, we assume that would also be okay and we get you out of the problem. Now, the Pischei Tshuva writes in the name of the Maharit. So what if you have somebody who is a baker and everybody comes to my store to buy one bagel? I only sell one bagel per customer. Let's say that's my store. So I make 1,000 bagels at a time, but I know everyone's going to eat it right now for their meal, just for lunch. So what would you say in a case like that? Is that considered like Rashi's heter of davar mu'at because everyone's going to eat it today? Or no, is that only when I have a store, when I have in my private home, and I'm making bread, and I'm going to eat it right away, then I can take responsibility for myself. But when I have a store, and I have many people coming in, and even if I'm only going to sell one at a time to each person, maybe we should say that we have a reason to be concerned. So this is a discussion in the Pischei Tshuva. The Pischei Tshuva is machmir, and he says, we would not allow you to go ahead and make, on a large scale, we would not allow a baker to make many challahs that are going to be milchiks, even if he's going to only sell one challah at a time, because we're concerned. You don't know what people are going to do when they go home, and this is not going to be permissible. And he brings a proof to this. I think the proof is very brilliant. The proof is as follows. The Gemara says, if a person goes ahead and bakes milchig bread, the Gemara says it's going to be kol hapas kula asura. The whole batch that you made of dough, everything you baked is going to be asur. If you don't follow these conditions of ke'ein tura, right? If you don't have either the strange form, or if you don't have a little bit. So let's say, the Gemara says, if I bake a lot of bread, and all of it is milchigs, that's considered to be usser. Ask the Yad Yehuda, why? Why don't you just go around to every neighbor, give out one challah to each person, and say, please eat it today, and now my bread is not going to be usser. Right? Isn't that davar mu'at, and you're going to eat it right away? Says the Yad Yehuda, no, it's not good enough. All the Gemara means to say, all Rashi explains here about the heter of Ke'ein Tura, that if I'm going to eat it right away, Miyad and Bevasachas are going to eat it right away, therefore, and it's like that, we don't have to be concerned. All Rashi meant was, when it happens in my own private home, and I could take responsibility for myself to eat it right away. But to go ahead and assume that others are going to follow the rules, that's not something that we can be comfortable doing, and therefore the Pischei Tshuva says, if you're a baker, you would not be able to rely on the opinion of Rashi to make even a little bit and give it out to all the community, because we still have to be concerned, maybe one of them is going to make a mistake. Now, when the Rif says that you have to make a strange kind of shape in order for the pas to be mutter, what is the Rif describing? Does he mean the way that I braid the challah while it's being kneaded and before I put it in the oven, that's what's going to allow me to make this milchig bread? Or is it even if I make the simen after the bread is baked already? For example, nowadays you put a label on the outside of the bread, So what do you say in a case like that? So this is a big discussion. The Piskei Tshuva quotes from the Chavos Das that the only time that it helps to make a strange form of the bread to get out of the problem of milchik bread is if you do it at the time that you're baking it. But the Chavos Das says, once you already bake the bread, it already became usur. What do I care that later on you go and you put a package on it that says, oh, this bread is milchik, and you put it in neon letters. What does it help? The bread already became usur when you put it in the oven. Once it came out of the oven, it's already usur. So what does it help later on to go and say, oh, I'm going to put a big sticker on it, a label that says exactly what the contour are of this bread. That's not going to help. It already became usur beforehand. Therefore, he says, it wouldn't help. The Chachmas Adam has a case where he quotes Rab Abel Pasveler, who was the Vilna Dayan at the time of the Chayi Adam, that they had the following story. Your case, where that's what I was thinking of before. Your case of where they were baking challah and meat in the oven at the same time, and chicken in the oven at the same time, and gravy from the chicken spilled out of the pan and went into the pan that had the challah. So now you have gravy, be'en gravy in the challah pan. So what are you going to do? You have fleshing your bread. And this wasn't planned beforehand, so he didn't shape it in a different way. So what does he do? So Rav Abel Pasveler Paskin, he should go and take the chicken bone and stick it into the challah. Why? Because that's the siman. So don't you see that that was done after the baking was over, meaning you took it out of the oven, you see that the gravy spilled on it. Rav Abel Pasveler said, right away, take the chicken bone and stick it into the thing, that's going to be the siman. Don't you see right away that even though it was already finished with the baking process, and seemingly it already became a challah sasuras once you baked it, don't you see that we would assume that a siman afterward is good enough? That's what the Chayi Adam argues. So my father said, no, it's not clear. Why? Because he can say he told him to do it while it was still burning hot, so the process of the baking is not over yet. But let's say after it already comes out of the oven, and now I'm packaging it, what does it help to put the label package? So my father quotes in his sefer in the name of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the father of the Rav, that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik was of the opinion, no problem at all, you're allowed to even put the sticker on the item after the baking was done, because what?
Just the sticker and nothing else?
No, meaning a recognizable simon, and it doesn't have to be done. Whatever. It doesn't have to be done at the time of the baking itself. Even if it's done later on, that's good enough as long as it's very recognizable. So my father said that the practice nowadays is not to be mekel like Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. This has to be done beforehand. But what my father did explain to us was that this disagreement between the Piskei Tshuva and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and the Chavos Das, and the Chayi Adam with the chicken bone in the challah, This machlokas, perhaps he thought was tali, was dependent on Rav Soloveitchik's fundamental understanding of what the Isser is in the first place. If you understand that the Isser is just a gzeira midrabanan, that maybe you're going to violate Mishum Hergel Aveira, so what do I care when the siman is put on? Either it's put on before it's baked or after it's baked. Bottom line, as long as you have something which is very recognizable, that's sufficient, that's good enough. As long as it's noticeable to people, if they get their hands on this challah, and they're not going to make the mistake, so what do I care if you put it on before or after? But if you assume that once you bake it, it now turns into a machalas asuras, now comes something like nevelas utrefas, now becomes like tevel, now becomes something which is really usur, then what does it help later on? Once it became usur, it's usur. Now that you're going to come later and put a sticker on it, what does that help you? Bottom line, it's usur. So that's what my father suggested. Perhaps that's the reason why this disagreement erupted and evolved as to whether or not you're allowed to put a siman on the bread after it's already baked, or do we assume no? Once it's already baked, then the game is up, and you no longer have the ability to go ahead and put a sticker on it or to put a label on it because it already has become a challah asuras. Yeah.
The gravy is spilling in, but what about the zeya from the?
That's the question he was asking.
But it's in the oven at the same time.
Yeah, that's why I'm not sure. So maybe you'll say it's shishim. I guess you'll say it's shishim. I don't know. Yeah.
Again, back to his point, which is that if the halacha is based on the Gemara, that there has to be an active measure of a person actually kneading the dough, that could be the gzera, which is why maybe here there were more makel, because it happened. It wasn't part of the activity of the person making the dough.
I don't know that that's true. I don't know. Again, I have to look into it. I don't know. I'm not sure what the answer is. But I think it's a good question about the zeh and the oven. I don't know. I think it's a good question. So then the final issue that we should discuss, but we don't have time, so you'll read a little bit on your own. That's why I put it on here. The final issue is about Asa Baba Kisnin. So how far do we take this? So now that we said that there's an issur of having milchik bread or fleshik bread, because maybe you're going to come to eat it with the other side, with the milchiks or the fleshiks, and you're not allowed to. So what do you do with crackers or with muffins or things like that that we assume are going to be milchiks? Let's say Thomas English muffins we know are milchiks, so why is that permissible? How does the OU give ashgach on that? Or we have crackers. I remember when I was in Israel, so they don't have kiddush in Israel like we have here. In Israel, when somebody has a baby, it's very simple. All the neighbors bring over something and they contribute to the food for the kiddush, and that's the kiddush, that's all they have. So when I was there, there was somebody who brought over liver and somebody else who brought over a box of crackers. Now, they didn't even think to look at the box of crackers, but box of crackers had an OUD on it. So I remember at the time, Rav Nissen Kaplan came over to me and he said, how does your father give ashgach on the crackers, OUD? Look what just happened. Everybody ate them on Shabbos with the liver. And now it turns out that they're eating basar v'challah. So I said, number one, so he said, oh, you know how much tshuva they have to do now because of your father? So I said to him, number one, the Nesivus writes that if you eat an issur d'rabbanan b'shogeg, you don't have to do tshuva on it at all. So I said, calm down. Their tshuva, don't worry about it, we'll figure out what to do. The problem is a more fundamental problem. Are we allowed to give a hashgacha on a cracker where the mistake can really happen? And the mistake did happen. So how are we allowed to give a hashgacha on a cracker if we're concerned that maybe somebody's going to serve it with the liver? So this is something that you have to look here. Now again, my father has pointed out on many occasions, the discussion about whether or not this gzeira applies to pasa babakisnan, let's say to crackers and to other items like that, muffins, is not whether or not, the crux of the issue is not whether or not we assume that this is lechem. We assume pasa babakisnan has a din of lechem. It certainly has a din of lechem. My father has proved this from many different cases in Shas, where we assume that pasa babakisnan passes as lechem. Just take for a very simple example. Ashkenazim hold that matzah is considered matzah, and we make a hamotzi. Svardim hold that matzah is considered pasa babakisnan. Right? They don't wash on it, except for on Pesach. They assume that that's considered hamotzi lechem aretz. But during the year, Svardim do not assume that our matzahs are considered. All they assume is it's pasa babakisnan. Well, if that's the case, how do we ever make an erev chatzeros with a matzah? Right? You have to use lechem. So how do you ever use a matzah? You're going to tell me the Svardi is not counted in the erev chatzeros because according to him, this is not considered a matzah. So we have many examples where we find pasa babakisnan and bottom line is considered lechem. So the issue over here about whether or not milchik bread applies to pasa babakisnan is not whether or not pasa babakisnan is considered lechem. It is considered lechem. The issue is, do we have a reason to be concerned? Meaning back in the times of the Gemara, they didn't used to eat crackers with the liver. So should we assume that this was part of the gzeira or not? Or should we assume nowadays when we do use it as part of the meal with the fleishigs once in a while, should we assume that that's an issue or not? So here I brought two different things that might be of interest to you. One is about the OU's heter to give a hashgach on dairy English muffins, which is very interesting because if you read through it, it comes out clearly that my father is not so enthralled by the heter, but then he says the only reason why it's really allowed is because there's not really chalav in it. It's less than shishim of chalav in it. It's such an insignificant amount of chalav, and that's the only reason they get it. And that's the bottom line on the crackers issue, which is on the second side of the page, you'll read as well. So Rav Nissen Kaplan had a good concern, but the bottom line is it's not really a concern because there's less than shishim of chalav in the cracker, and when you have less than shishim, obviously we assume this would be not considered an isser at all. So this is basically most of the issue about milchik bread. Bottom line is it's something we should be aware of, we should be concerned about. And it's something we should make sure that Shavuos time we don't have an issue. One thing I neglected to mention was that when Rashi says the reason why it's permissible kain tura is because you eat it just for a small amount of time, you're going to eat it right away and there's no reason to be concerned, maybe a mistake is going to come out of it. So that Rashi, I'm sorry, the Ramah, who quotes that Rashi lahalacha, the Ramah also writes, this is why in Shavuos you're allowed to make the milchik bread. Why? Because Shavuos is only one day, it's only 2 days, it's a small yamtiv, and we know you're going to eat it right away. You're making the bread special for Shavuos. So therefore he says this would not be a concern at all. The Beis Yosef says, no, that's not the reason why it's allowed. The reason why it's allowed is because everybody knows the Shavuos challahs are going to be in a different shape. And if they're going to be in a different shape, that's the reason why there's no reason for anyone to make a mistake. No one's going to have any confusion about whether or not they're allowed to eat it with the meal that they happen to be eating now. Okay,